Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Government statisticians told us today there is still basically no inflation in the American economy, which does kind of make you wonder if they drive or eat, doesn't it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have arrived at Friday, the 15th of April. Good to have you with us, everybody. There are two ways to look at the inflation report that came out this morning. One is in the cold, analytical, one might say bloodless way that economists and analysts like to do it. What they call core inflation doesn't count food and energy, and it was up just a tenth of 1% last month. The other way to do it is the way regular people live, eating and driving, like these folks.
Everything is higher and highest.
My wife does the shopping for that stuff, so I have no idea what the costs of anything else are.
We haven't seen it yet. I think it's too early right now.
Anything that's kind of produced or manufactured has to be shipped over here, right? So oil prices are going up. It's obviously going to affect prices.
The main thing that I've noticed an increase in that has hurt my budget the most has been gas.
That was Vanessa Robbins in Washington, Arthur Seguini and Raul Banuelos, Tony Murillo, and Melissa Farwell here in Los Angeles. The next voice you're going to hear is Marketplace's David Gura on why the government ignores the way we live.
For one thing, if you look at energy prices and the cost of food, they bounce around a lot. Gus Fouché is an economist with Moody's Analytics.
Gasoline prices can go up sharply in one month and then they can fall off in the next month because of, you know, higher oil prices and global geopolitical concerns.
Lately, there's been turmoil in the Middle East, and bad weather can change food prices. Michelle Girard is with RBS. She says that's why the Federal Reserve uses core inflation when it sets interest rates.
Policymakers can't just sort of say, okay, we need to respond to the big increase, and then when they reverse, we need to respond to the decline. I mean, that would just, we'd have interest rates going up and down all over the place.
The Fed's powers are limited. If an earthquake or a revolution changes commodity prices, it can't do a whole lot. But Girard says Ben Bernanke and his colleagues don't live in a bubble. They know what a tank of gas costs and what that means for the whole economy. Rising food and energy prices affect other things. If oil goes up, you could pay more for a train ticket or a new TV. Nigel Galt, chief economist at IHS Global Insight, looks for that kind of spillover. He says prices for most other goods and services didn't go up that much, which suggests...
with consumers really being squeezed by these higher food and energy costs, their spending power being reduced, that it's quite difficult to push through prices in other areas because consumers are going to resist.
And if they keep resisting, it could be because of the cost of gas. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a reasonably tranquil Friday for everybody but Google. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last week, about this time, we were all waiting around to see whether the government would have to close up shop as Congress debated the budget. Uncle Sam is still with us, but so is the debate over debt and federal spending. And so, too, are Felix Salmon of Reuters fame, also John Carney from CNBC, here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Gentlemen, good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
So here's what I want to do. I want to take this budget debate that has been happening at the center of the political universe and move it like 230 miles up I-95 to New York and ask you guys, outside the political scenario, how worried are Wall Streeters about debt and the deficit and all that, John?
Bond markets are very worried. They think that the closer we get to reaching anything like the debt ceiling, the more the market is going to be in a lot of trouble. None of them really believe that there's any possibility that the debt ceiling won't be raised, but they do believe that you could make a lot of international investors in U.S. debt worried if you get too close.
Surely, though, Felix, everybody realizes it's all political talk and that in the end, the vote will come and the debt ceiling will be raised.
Yes, exactly. And I have to disagree with John on this one. This is political theater. I have seen no evidence in the bond markets that there's any actual genuine worry about what's going to happen. Everyone knows what's going to happen. It's always happened in the past. It will always happen in the future. The United States will always pay its debts in a timely fashion. And in the big picture, there's really nothing to worry about here.
All right, but I'll tell you what. Let's just humor John Carney just because we're those kind of guys and ask him to expound on what bad things might happen, John. Let's give some give folks some tangible sense of what might happen.
Right. Well, the last time we came close to not raising the debt ceiling, you saw dramatic outflows of foreign investment in U.S. government debt. The U.S. government debt is much larger now, and so if you saw similar levels of outflows, the Treasury could be in a lot of trouble, and you could see interest rates expand rapidly. The debt ceiling will happen around the same time that the Federal Reserve stops buying Treasuries
when
quantitative easing ends.
Right.
The combination of these two things has people worried.
All right, Felix, that's got me a little uptight.
Well, the end of quantitative easing, as it's known, is definitely something which the bond market is worried about, and they've started to price in, but you know, no one knows whether it's fully reflected in prices yet. I think that's the really big story over the next few months. I don't, as I say, think that the debt ceiling part of it is going to be such a big deal, because I think we've learned how much political theater there is, and I think we've learned to ignore it until basically it's too late. If the debt ceiling really is reached and not raised, and the government can't borrow any money, and people start having to shut down operations and borrow from various side pocket accounts and that kind of thing in a very desperate attempt to stay solvent and not default on the debt, then people will worry. But we're a long, long way from that yet. And I think that, amazing though it might sound, saner minds are going to prevail yet again in Washington, D.C.
John, how long are we from something really bad happening? I mean, objectively here.
We're still a few months out from something really bad happening. The government, you know, sort of will begin to run out of room to borrow in May, but they can extend that into June. But sometime this summer, the debt ceiling has to be raised. It almost certainly will. The question is, how scary do they make it for bond investors before they do? Remember that in this last budget debate, they waited until the last possible minute to arrive at a deal, and it could have fallen apart at the last minute. If they try to push it to the last minute to arrange a deal to raise the debt ceiling, and they fail by accident because they can't get the votes together, that could be a real scary thing, and that's what people are going to worry about in the bond markets.
And
to John's point, this is an embarrassing and stupid way of running a democracy, and the fact that the greatest country in the world is trying to govern itself this way with these artificial constraints on how much debt it can have and leaving everything to the last minute and squabbling along partisan lines about Planned Parenthood and all of this other ridiculousness, it makes the United States look really stupid in the eyes of the rest of the world. It might not force them to sell their treasury bonds, but people are rolling their eyes here. It's a bit like, you know, Bush versus Gore in 2000. People are looking at us going, what on earth do these people think they're doing?
Felix Salmon blogs for Reuters. John Carney blogs for CNBC. Guys, we'll see you later.
Thank you.
Honda announced today slowdowns at its North American assembly plants are going to continue until at least next month. The company said its factories in Japan simply can't replace the production capacity they lost after the earthquake. Marketplace's Scott Tong has been reporting this week about some of the people who are going to have to help get the Japanese economy up and running again. Today, a working mom who had been balancing family life and a factory job at an auto parts factory. A job that, as it turns out, may never come back. Here's Scott.
Even before the quake, the economic ground was shifting under Japan's feet. So says 43-year-old factory worker Emiko Shiga. We found her at a shelter for displaced people, some 40 miles outside Tokyo. Back home in Fukushima, she worked quality control at a factory. It made some of the 10,000 parts of your car, the seatbelt buckle, the steel piece of your ashtray. But now she spends her hours tailing a precocious first grader around the shelter. Shiga's daughter is
6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
And does what comes naturally in the presence of a microphone. As her daughter skips rope near a long row of porta-johns, Shiga tells me how on March 11th, her factory was badly damaged in the quake. Then the nuclear plant in the neighborhood started spewing radiation. Everyone in town was moved out. Her company's HR reps have checked in on her, but Shiga's received no paycheck for the last month. No word on when the factory will resume or whether.
Even before the quake, prices for our products were falling because of competition from China. We were sort of worried whether we'd stay in business. Now we're even less sure.
But she insists, gently, that you can't match Japanese quality.
In Japan, our factories are making the best products at reasonable cost, and we deliver fast.
Japanese automakers have long preferred domestic suppliers, but competition from China is disrupting everything, says Toshinori Nemoto at Hitotsubashi University in Tokyo.
The Japanese auto manufacturers are thinking to import parts from China now. It has just started.
Now, here's an argument not everyone in Japan will like. Offshoring is good for Japan, says economist Yukio Noguchi at Tokyo's Waseda University. He says, for rich countries, manufacturing is not where the money is. It's in services.
Like finance, consulting, IT-related activities, and so forth. These are very profitable activities.
And he says, the post-industrial poster child, America, and its companies that have made the transition. He's talking about companies like IBM, which now sells expertise instead of products.
U.S. has already achieved it. Japan tried to stick to manufacturing industry. This is a chance to follow the United States.
Now, some in the U.S., in manufacturing states like Michigan, argue that's not where you want to go. And some workers here in Japan wouldn't choose that path either. Like blue-collar mom Emiko Shiga. Today, she's getting her daughter ready for first grade. The new school year is just starting, and this is the first grade song. It's a happy tune about climbing Mount Fuji with 100 friends, and a happy distraction from the trauma of recent weeks. Shiga's daughter is now attending a local school as they wait out the nuclear crisis back in Fukushima. Shiga sighs. She wonders if they'll ever move back.
I started to look for a job around here, though I don't know if the same type of quality inspection work is available. If I have to, I'll work on an assembly line. My family depends on my income.
Emiko Shiga's gotta press on.
Thank you very much.
In Saitama, Japan, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Wall Street managed a modest rally this Friday, pushed the Dow Industrials average up 56 points. That's almost a half percent, 12,341. Lagging tech stocks weighed on the NASDAQ, though. It struggled to a four-point gain, a tenth of 1%, finished at 2764. The S&P 500 finally moved out of three straight days in neutral, attacked on 5 points today, a third of 1%, closed at 1319. For the week, the Dow lost 0.3%. The NASDAQ and the S&P each fell 0.6%. Google definitely not clicking today with investors who were apparently in search of better profits than the online powerhouse reported yesterday. Google shares downloaded 8.25%. That's their hardest fall in a year. Bond prices rose. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.41%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders releases its monthly report on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. The Jewish holiday of Passover begins at sunset. And they took his thumb in the Pope of Greenwich Village. But he continued to get other gigs. Actor Eric Roberts will be 55. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The governor of Georgia said today he's going to sign a tough new immigration law the state legislature passed last night. It's a lot like the one in Arizona that's on hold in the courts at the moment. Among other things, it would let Georgia police officers check the immigration status of people that they stop for questioning. How all this plays out is being watched pretty carefully in Utah, which has three new immigration laws of its own. They are gentler than what other states have done, but still not without controversy. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler paid a visit.
In this remote stretch of central Utah, there are more cattle than people. Maria Nye owns about 3,000 dairy cows.
Rosie, how are you?
This is one of my daughter's show cows, and she's spoiled and she knows it.
Some might say the local workforce is also spoiled.
I have never had a high school kid who wanted to come milk cows. Drive tractors, drive trucks, all that fun stuff, sure.
Milking cows is one of those grubby jobs most Americans don't want. Nye says her workers are here legally, but none were born in this country. That shouldn't be surprising, says neighboring dairy farmer and state legislator Bill Wright.
I asked my legislative cohorts, how many of them are encouraging their sons to go to school and pick fruit? Well, there's none of them. We all think the neighbor's going to do it. Yeah, neighbor's kids are like yours. They're just as spoiled as yours. They're not going to do it either.
I spoke with Wright at the farmhouse he built with the help of his 10 kids. He's the author of a new law that would bring foreign laborers out of the shadows by giving them guest worker visas.
You have to have background checks. You have to be paying your taxes. You have to be willing to work.
Of course, states can't set immigration policy. That's up to the feds. So even though it was signed into law last month, the guest worker program won't go into effect for 2 years, giving Utah time to seek a waiver from the federal government.
We have a responsibility to petition that federal government to say, we have a problem, we're willing to help, you can stick your head in the sand, or maybe you might want to look at some ideas we have.
His ideas include making undocumented workers in the state pay a fine of a few thousand dollars. But after that, they could apply for a guest worker visa. State Representative Christopher Herod opposes the law.
For me, it's fundamentally unfair to the tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of people that are trying to come here legally.
Herod's wife is from the Ukraine, so he knows firsthand about the challenge of emigrating to this country legally. And Herod says the guest worker program amounts to amnesty for people who broke the rules.
That is pure and simple amnesty, and I wish they would have the courage to call it that.
Bill Wright denies that his new law provides any pathway to citizenship.
It would not. Guest worker permit is good for the duration of your working. You're not eligible to be in the state if you're not working.
The legislation has inspired fiery rhetoric. Activists on the left go so far as to suggest the law condones slave labor. Conservative critics accuse Wright of promoting illegal immigration.
A lot of the negative calls are more personal attacks. They're very angry. They're very vindictive.
The guest worker law wasn't intended to be controversial. In fact, the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce supported the legislation because it wanted to avoid the PR pitfalls of Arizona's approach. Chamber spokesman Marty Carpenter.
Utah is a tourism-heavy state. We depend on it in our economy. And Arizona lost close to $500 million in convention bookings alone. We were not in a position to have that same thing happen.
Foreign workers help staff Utah ski resorts. They work as hotel maids and restaurant dishwashers, not to mention construction and agriculture. Back at the dairy, Maria Nye says people are mistaken in thinking that farmers want to hire immigrants in order to get cheap labor.
I don't consider them cheap labor at all. They are very skilled in what they do. We basically start at about $9 an hour and go up from there. And there are people who work for us who take home more money than I do.
Bill Wright says foreign workers invest a lot of that money locally. They buy cars and houses. He argues that these folks are intertwined in the society. If they were all sent packing, he says, it would devastate the economy. In Delta, Utah, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We had Robert Zoellick on the broadcast earlier this week. He's the president of the World Bank. And we were talking about the bank's spring meetings in Washington this weekend. Also about the bank's role in the Middle East. Both the World Bank and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, said not all that long ago that the region's economics were doing pretty well. But commentator Samour Shahata says the numbers just don't lie.
Many Arab economies suffer from high unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, poverty, uneven development, deteriorating education and health systems, and generally poor governance. Over the last decade, however, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have focused more on macroeconomic indicators than on how real people in these countries are doing. They champion neoliberal economic policies in countries such as Tunisia and Egypt, policies such as market deregulation, currency devaluation, massive subsidy cuts, and privatization. These reforms, it was claimed, produced high growth rates and record levels of foreign direct investment. Yet these same policies, in the context of Egypt and Tunisia's crony capitalism, simultaneously produced high inflation and declining real wages and increasing levels of poverty and income inequality, according to the World Bank and IMF's own statistics. In Tunisia, for example, unemployment reached 14.7% in 2009 and 46% for university graduates. The North African country was also characterized by tremendously uneven development, with prospering coastal areas and neglected interior regions. But it was dubbed an economic miracle. Egypt is even more telling. Egypt received the World Bank's Top Reformer Award in 2008. But poverty and income inequality were rising, corruption was increasing, and rule of law was deteriorating. And the country was witnessing the largest strike wave in its history. It's time for international financial institutions to rethink neoliberal economic policies. It's also time to move beyond GDP growth rates when assessing human development. Well-being and development need to be measured by how real people are doing. Poverty levels, unemployment, income inequality, and social justice are more important than growth rates or stock market indices. Because at the end of the day, as Egypt's former prime minister once admitted, people don't eat macroeconomic indicators.
Samor Shahada is an assistant professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University. Do take a second and share your thoughts with us. Marketplace.org is the website. The link is the one that says contact. There's going to be a rare meeting in Havana this weekend, the first Cuban Communist Party Congress to be held in 14 years. There will be special mention of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, which was 50 years ago this Sunday. But a lot of the discussion is going to be about Cuba's economic reforms. Last year, President Raul Castro created a private sector made up of 178 different kinds of jobs, everything from locksmiths to gardeners to tour guides. That's a big deal in a country where 95% of the population works for the government. But Grant Fuller reports from Cuba, it's an awkward marriage of socialism and capitalism.
21-year-old Salvador Valle leans on a chain-link fence in the small beachside town of Guanabo. He's one of many Cubans in a nervous trial period right now, trying to make the best of his country's free market experiment.
I'm a tire mechanic and repairman. That's the job I chose to get a license for because it's a necessity here. If you get stranded with a flat tire on your car, bike, tractor, or whatever, you're going to have to get it fixed.
And fixed often. Most of Cuba's cars are classic American models from the 1950s, and they take a beating on potholed roads. So Valle's skill is in high demand. Charging only a dime to fix a flat, he's not raking it in. In fact, he struggles to make a dollar a day. But he says for young people like him, self-employment is a chance to break free from the shackles of government wages. After all, the monthly salary for public employees is just $10 to $20.
I have to buy disposable diapers for my son that cost $12. If I worked for the state, I'd have to work for a full month to buy one package. And if I use that money for diapers, then how do I eat? How do I buy clothes for my wife and I?
At a weekend street market in Havana, about a dozen vendors are trying out this new system of free enterprise. Next to state-run food stalls that were always there, private citizens line the sidewalk with card tables. They sell everything from plants and household items to coffee and jewelry. Lázaro Delgado has set up a new sidewalk flower stand. He agreed to an interview, but only behind closed doors in his apartment. He says he makes $2 a day. That's three times the salary of the average Cuban.
This is the best thing the Cuban government has done to help us. They're giving everyone the chance to work, helping us all start doing something. The state is giving us a chance to make it.
But for other Cubans, President Raul Castro's grand plan seems to have backfired.
I have a license to be a dance instructor, but I think I'm going to go to the office and give it back tomorrow because I cannot afford it.
This man in Havana used to work for a government funeral home, but he injured himself and could no longer lift the heavy caskets. So when he heard about the reform, he snapped up permission to open a dance school. Problem is, he has no money for the startup capital he needs, a stereo system and a studio space. And taxes are high, as much as 40% of his income.
I felt really proud when I got the license. But I talked to my family, and we decided it is best just to give up. If they lower the taxes, though, I probably will go back and get the license again.
During an extended meeting of the Council of Ministers presided by President Raul Castro,
the government recently announced that Cuban banks will provide small loans to private businesses, helping them get off the ground. Cuban state media heavily promotes the change, like in this radio news spot.
This measure includes the approval of loans to authorize...
But skeptics wonder if the banks can actually follow through. The hope for new business owners is that Castro will indeed lower self-employment taxes at this weekend's Communist Party Congress. In Havana, I'm Grant Fuller for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a plea from Federal Budget Director Jack Lew, who, as you might imagine, has a lot on his plate these days, and he's trying to head off some trouble at the pass. Lew is asking media organizations not to run those countdown clocks as we get closer to the debt limit. Yes, cable news, he's talking to you. Even though Carney and Salmon assured us earlier in the broadcast that we will never get there, Lew says the mere fact of anticipation would undermine our position as an economic power. Those are his words, so here are mine. No countdown clocks here, but hey, TikTok. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow rallied 56 points, almost 0.5%. The NASDAQ nudged up 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500, why it tacked on 5 points, about 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is a guy by the name of J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, it has been 1 year since the BP oil spill, a year of choices for people living on the Gulf Coast.
Do I wait for a larger settlement, or do I take my sanity? And the sanity won out.
Good on you. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back here Monday afternoon. This is APM, American Public Media. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.